Tonight we will be in the book of Esther, if you want to take your Bibles there. And we will be finishing up our study of the history of Israel from creation to restoration. I wanted to just mention, this has been quite the journey because we've been studying this particular subject all year this year. We started in January in Genesis, and we made our way through this material until now. And so I know that's been, you know, quite the journey, and I appreciate all of you that have kept up with that. I'll remind you that in our adult curriculum, the way that we've designed the curriculum is that we kind of have a 6-year Bible curriculum. In the first 3 years of that 6-year curriculum, we make sure that we go through the Old Testament like 3 times. The first time we do it, we go 1 book a week, and we have these charts that we go through, and we kind of study what is each book about. The second time we went through it, we just went through and studied like names and important events, and we had kind of like facts of Old Testament history. And then this last time we went a little bit slower and took our time to sort of walk through the Old Testament history. So what that's hopefully does is if you're someone who's new to the Old Testament story, hopefully by going through it those 3 times, you've captured a lot more and gathered more sort of an understanding of the timeline of Bible history. And for those of you that are familiar with it, it's a good reminder, and we try to dig into a couple of things from time to time to make sure that we keep it fresh. So before we get started with this, I'll say a prayer here in just a minute, but let's do a couple of memory things. I haven't made you do this in a while, so let's say the Old Testament books together, nice and loud. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Very good. Hopefully you have those memorized. And we took the first 17 books, Genesis through Esther, and we separated those into 12 divisions of Old Testament history. So if you know those, say them with me. Pre-flood, post-flood, patriarchal, bondage, wanderings, conquest, judges, united kingdom, divided kingdom, Judah alone, captivity, restoration. Good. At what point does this story of Esther take place in that? All right, in the restoration period. But even though Esther comes after Ezra and Nehemiah in your Bible, the story of Esther doesn't take place chronologically after Nehemiah, right? If you go back to Ezra and you look at the chart here, there's a gap of about 60 years between chapter 6 and 7 of Ezra. The first returning captives came with who? Who was the leader of that first return? Zerubbabel and Joshua. And then there's this period of time that elapses, and that's when the story of Esther takes place. And then you have the second half of the book of Ezra, and Ezra leads that return. And then the third return is under who? Nehemiah. First return under Zerubbabel, they rebuilt what? What did Zerubbabel rebuild? The temple. And then Ezra comes back, and what's his concern when he comes back? The law and the what? The walls is Nehemiah, so he's the third one. So God has them build the temple, then he has them reestablish kind of law and order and getting people connected again with the priesthood. And then finally, Nehemiah comes much, much later and builds the walls around the city, right? So we are going to talk about the story that takes place in the book of Esther. Just notice kind of the way this book lays out. You have the first three chapters present the problem, and then 4 through 10 are the resolution to the problem. You can kind of set the problem up this way. There's a setting in chapter 1 that's a very Gentile setting. It's very different than what we would normally see among the Jews, because we're looking at the Persian kings, specifically a Persian king named what? Ahasuerus or Xerxes, and he does something we'll talk about in a minute. And then that we're introduced to Esther in the second chapter, and she then becomes the primary sort of central figure of the book. But we'll talk all about that. So the theme of this book is that God's people are threatened, and the existence of the Jews is threatened by the plot that's hatched here. But eventually, the book resolves itself by these Jews being able to protect themselves, and they are not annihilated, and God saves his people this way. Before we jump into the details, what are your thoughts about the fact that this story, Esther's at the end of Israel's history? Do you think there's anything we're supposed to learn by kind of where it is in the canon of the Bible? Like, why not put it back in, you know, right after Ezra? Why wait till after Nehemiah? This is a really sort of strange book to end Israel's history, but there might be some thoughts that you have about why that would be. Any thoughts around that? Clay?
It shows that through all the things they've been through, the 12 things you just talked about, God is still continuing to be with them and take care of them in captivity, bondage, and restoration. God is still in charge of what's going on no matter where they're at.
All right, good, very good. So this is something that's not even happening in Israel, right? This is happening a long way away from where the restoration's taking place, and yet God's still active. God's still protecting his people. We can talk a little bit more about that. Other thoughts about that? Now, I don't want to have to call on you, Rob, but I want to, like, you made a really interesting comment to me last week, so do you mind articulating some of that?
No, it's, some people have the opinion that Esther, the book of Esther, God isn't mentioned. And so it's kind of a story of even when people are seeking God and seeking God's providence and help, that God still delivers through people who aren't seeking him.
All right, very good. So most of you are probably familiar with this, but God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. Like, you'll never see his name. You won't see anybody reference him. And that makes it a very unique book in the Bible, because God's never mentioned. But his presence is obviously felt, right? And so what Rob's pointing out is all the other stories of the restoration, Ezra, Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, they keep saying, God, we need your help. God, please help us. God's the reason that this is going on. And yet the Israel's history ends with this book where he's never even mentioned by the writer. But you can tell as you read it that he's the only reason, really, that the people of Israel still exist. And so if you contrast Esther with the others, it's a really interesting, almost like a commentary on, you've got these people that are living over in Persia that have not made their way back to Israel. They don't speak about God. They don't talk about God. And yet God still is delivering them. And that's very interesting. So Larry, then Sherry.
Do I remember correctly that Esther is the only book that isn't mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls?
I don't remember that. I don't know. So, could be. Does anybody else know the information on that? Like, somewhere in the back of my head, that sounds right, but
I'd be guessing. So I don't remember. Sure.
It also explains, too, when God spares these people in a foreign land, but they stay there. It explains when we get to, like, the book of Acts, why there are Jews all over the world still.
Yeah, very good. as Sharon's pointing out, it kind of helps us understand, even in the Old Testament, that there were Jewish people all over the place, right? There were Jews still in Persian provinces. There were Jews that had been scattered to other places. And that was going to be part of what the New Testament would talk about, where eventually many of them would make their way back to Jerusalem and they would find their Messiah and God would sort of accomplish some things with that. So, good. All right, anything to add to that? All right, chapter 1 of Esther sets the scene. And the book begins by Ahasuerus having this huge celebration. What year of his reign is it? Third year. And the third year of his reign, he decides to sort of throw this extended party to celebrate like how great his kingdom is. How long is this event that he throws? All right, so it's the feast at the end of it is like 7 days, right? But before that, it's like 180 days of this like celebration for him, which is very interesting to think about. Any other, is there anything that we're hinted at about the character of Xerxes, Ahasuerus, in this beginning chapter? I mean, you can almost see it just from that, like that he would invite like every important person in the province to come look at how great he was for this long. But what else is he like? Yeah, Mina? Okay. Yeah, he's a very powerful man, and his emotions can kind of get the best to him, the best of him. He seems to be a man with certain appetites and vices that cause him some trouble. He loves to drink, and we find him really doing and making some decisions when he's drinking a lot that maybe aren't the best. He seems to appreciate women, at least in the wrong ways, right? Because what's kind of the conflict in the chapter? One of these days when he's very drunk at the end of this party, Jay?
Show off his wife and queen to all of his fellow partiers, and she won't do it.
All right. He calls for his queen, Vashti, very beautiful woman the Bible describes, asks her to basically parade her beauty in front of all these others. And she refuses. She says no. Any thoughts about that? Is Vashti a rebel? Is she a hero? Is that not even the point of the story? What do you think? No opinions, huh? Sharon?
I'll take a snap. Up in verse 4, when he talks about he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty. You get the impression that she's part of that. You know, he's got the most beautiful wife, so he's going to parade her in front of all of these men who have been drinking for days, wants her to put her crown on and show off her beauty, and she's saying, I'm not going to be an object like that of your kingdom where you're just going to put me on display. So I think, in my opinion, what she did would be our preferred decision that God would choose us to have if that were us.
Okay. Agree with that? You know, typically the Bible says that we are to obey the authorities that are in place. I mean, this is not only the king, this is also her husband. And she refuses, of course, these are Gentiles, so this may not have a lot to do with anything. But the fact that she would say no to him, that's extraordinary, because he could, if he wanted to, just kill her for something like that. And so I think it's a fairly extraordinary moment in at least Persian history, if not just human history. Yeah.
For instance, when we talk about what should we do with Vashti, and we talk about what we need to make sure that this doesn't become the norm, so you need to kind of put her away so that other, our wives respect us or whatever.
Yeah, it's almost a funny story when all the men get together and say, "What are we going to do about this woman who's not listening to her husband and he's the king?" Well, we need to make it very clear that this is not okay. I am also surprised, and there may be reasons why they weren't able to kill her, or maybe that wouldn't have been a great political move, but they do banish her, and they say that they're going to replace her with someone else, and they send out letters everywhere to say, like, this is what's happening, and men are the king of their castles and the head of their families, and you need to do what's right with that. But that kind of sets the scene, yeah.
Lightning is pregnant at this time, because shortly after this, he goes off to war and loses a bunch of battles, but when he comes back, he then has a son. And we see that in Ezra 4.
Okay.
Yeah, where his son takes, his son with Vashti takes command after him.
Okay. Is that mentioned? It's her son? Like, she's named as the mother? Okay, I was unaware of that, so that's interesting. Okay, I'd have to do some research on that. So,
it's not in Ezra 4, but his name is mentioned in Ezra 4. I forget where it says that he is the son of her.
Okay, interesting. All right, anything to add to that? So because they're going to replace her, the story goes on into chapter 2, and the plan is to gather all of the most beautiful virgins that they can find in the kingdom, and the king is going to make a choice from those virgins. How long is this process that Esther becomes a part of to win the heart of the king? Basically, it's the ultimate, like, episode of The Bachelor, I guess, or the season of The Bachelor, one of the original times. Yeah.
12 months, but she was in month 8.
All right, very good. So it was supposed to go on for about a year, and they had, like, you know, all these months of beautification and, like, moments with the king, and yet she sort of fast-tracks that because of her charm and her beauty, and ends up being the one that the king chooses to be his wife, right? We're introduced not just to Esther. What's Esther's other name? Does anybody remember? Hadassah, in chapter 2, verse 7. She has an uncle, and his name is what? Mordecai. What do we learn about Mordecai in chapter 2? What's that? All right, he's raising Esther, so he's obviously concerned about the fact that she's chosen. He goes by all the time to visit where she would be so that he can make sure she's doing all right. But something significant happens towards the end of chapter 2 with Mordecai. He learns about a plot against the king. He finds out that there's some guys that are going to try to take his life. And so he tells Esther to pass that on to the king, or the king's people. And it turns out that it's a legitimate threat, and his life is spared because Mordecai spoke up, and Esther also helped with that. All right. Any comments about any of that? All right. In chapter 3, we're introduced to a new character. Who's that? All right. A man named Haman. And he's an important official within that regime. And what's the story with Haman? What happens with him? And especially Mordecai.
He's very prideful.
All right, he's prideful. How's that shown?
Great importance in the kingdom.
All right. Yeah.
He's supposed to be, I guess, bowed to by decree, and Mordecai won't bow to him. And he takes that very personally, and since it makes that the reason that he wants to destroy all
All right, very good. All right, very good. So Haman is being honored by many, and it says that most people are bowing to Haman, except for Mordecai. Mordecai won't give that kind of honor to him. Let's just talk about this just for a minute. If you look at chapter 3, verse 3, the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why are you transgressing the king's command?" So if this was something the king commanded and Mordecai's not doing it, he's got to have a pretty strong reason to do that, right? What do you think it is? Yeah, he's just not, he's simply not going to bow to anybody but God, right? Is that kind of the idea? We've seen things like this before with some of the Jews in exile, where they wouldn't bow to a king's image, they wouldn't bow down when the Persians or the Babylonians asked them to. Mordecai seems to be similar to this. But notice this, does Mordecai hate the king? How do you know? Saved his life. Notice this, I think it's one of the best stories in the Bible to like figure out how to walk this sort of line between having the right attitude towards those in authority, but also having convictions to not overstep when we shouldn't. Because this isn't Mordecai just having something personal against the king or against Haman. This is his convictions. But he proves that he's not someone who just hates this Persian regime because he makes sure he saves the life of the king. So I think you take the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3 and you find a very nuanced, sort of complex man in Mordecai who's navigating all of this. So, all right. Any other thoughts about that? Clay?
It's the same way they do attack Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is they'll try and put you're following God instead of the king. Which is like you said, it's not really the case, but they'll try and draw a line where it's one or the other, you serve one or the other. And I think in some ways that's the same thing we have to be careful of here. We're serving God, we're serving our president or whoever's leading our country. We can do both until it gets to some point where those cross.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Well said. Anything else to add to that? So as Peter pointed out, Haman's not just angry at Mordecai. Haman wants not only Mordecai dead, but he wants to wipe out all of the Jews. Because notice that he recognizes that the reason this is happening is because the Jews are different. The Jews don't have the same outlook on all of this as all the other nations that have been conquered by the Persians. So he goes to the king, and he has the king make a law and send out sort of correspondence that everyone within the kingdom would be given permission to kill all of the Jews that they could find in their region, right? They're just going to annihilate the nation. Any thoughts about any of that? Where were some of the Jews that were living at this time? Jerusalem, right? Were the Jews in Jerusalem, did they have enemies that hated them, surrounding them? Yeah, I remember the stories in Ezra and Nehemiah, right? Do you think letters reached those places as well? That would be the assumption, right? Now, we're not told any of that story. Like, we don't know what happened away from the capital of Persia here. But you have to imagine that these letters, as they begin to circulate, would have been of great concern for Jews wherever they were, even in Jerusalem at the time. All right, anything to add to that? All right, look at the beginning of chapter 4 then. Chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out in the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. He went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. In each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. So you get this sense that not only there, but everywhere that this was, Jewish people were troubled by it. They're praying, they're fasting, they're crying out to God. God could have done this, could have dealt with this in a lot of ways, right? We've seen that in Israel's history. God could have caused some nation to come and wipe out the Persians. God could have done a lot of different things. But this story unfolds very differently. So, by the way, if you want to get my attention, just get my attention to add anything. But look at verse 4 now. Then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish, and she sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered her to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for the destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her to order her to go to the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. Before we read any further, let's talk about this. What does Esther seem concerned with here? Like, what's Esther's issue? It says she's writhing in anguish. Well, what's she concerned about at this moment? What's that?
Because he can have a fiddle.
Okay, well, before Mordecai gives her the order, like I'm talking about what we just read, she tries to send clothes to him to tell him to put some clothes on and to stop doing what he's doing, because all she knows is that he's causing a scene out here. Why would this trouble her? It doesn't seem like she knows about the edict yet, right? Why would it trouble her that Mordecai is causing such a scene and she's asking him to stop it? And it's not until Mordecai informs her through the eunuch that she understands kind of everything that's going on. So there was one thing, we didn't talk about this yet. When Esther became queen, what was Mordecai's advice to her? Don't tell them who you are or who your heritage is, right? And imagine Esther living with that sort of secret and Mordecai causing a scene about whatever's going on. She probably can see that it's not just Mordecai, but Jews in general. I don't think she fully grasps yet, like, what's happening until Mordecai explains, look, here's the script, here's the text, here's what's being said, and I'm going to ask you to go and talk to the king now. And like you said, Vina, that's a scary proposition, isn't it? Because not only is she going to go before the king, and if she's not really asked to go before the king, you can die by trying to approach him. But the other part is, in order to really work through this, what's Esther going to have to reveal? She's going to have to reveal her heritage, right? She lied on the resume, or she maybe just left it off. She didn't really lie, but... Okay, anything to add to that? Let's keep reading here, verse 9. Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he is put, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. They related Esther's words to Mordecai. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. Some versions say you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. All right. Any thoughts about this interaction here? Yeah.
It seems like if there was any time in which God would speak to someone, it would be this situation, to explain to Esther what her duty and responsibility was. And she had to determine what that should be based on the opportunity she had.
Yeah. And this would be tough, wouldn't it? I mean, imagine how Esther's life has changed after coming into, you know, this household, this palace. Do you think Esther's life is far different than anything she had ever experienced before? For sure. And now her way of life is being threatened. Now the thought of doing something like this would be an extraordinary thing to work through for sure. Yeah, Vina.
Verse 14 is one of the main verses that really show God's influence in this book, whether his name is mentioned or not. And that because Mordecai says, whether you do this or not, you know, it'll get taken care of.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's right. You can hear Mordecai's faith in this, can't you? You see that he understands that God's made promises to the Jews. The Jews aren't going to be annihilated. God's already sort of proven that time and time again in their history. But Mordecai also realizes, look, somebody needs to do something, and either you do it or somebody else is going to, there's going to be some other way this is going to happen, but who knows whether or not this is the reason you're here, which is a pretty reasonable argument to make, I think. Although, if I'm Esther, that's one of those moments where you might shrug and say, well, if God's going to get it done some other way, then why do I have to put my life on the line, right? So, it's an interesting moment. Anything to add to that? So the speech works. Look at verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. And thus I will go in to the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. So she makes the decision. She's going to take her life into her own hands. Again, I know that's a hard thing. Like if you really try to make that real life for a minute, that you have a moment in your life where you know you're either just going to live or die in this moment, but you're going to do it because you believe it's the right thing to do. That's an extraordinary moment for her.
To come to the king when he was called, and now she's going to the king, which is against the law.
Good.
So he's already shown, you know, he stopped this from spreading through the kingdom, disobedient women, and now she's following right in those footsteps again.
Yeah, very good point.
She was gonna die.
Very good point. I mean, the story started by a woman being disobedient to the laws of the king, or at least the customs, refusing an order, and here she's going to go against the law and try to approach him. And he's already proven himself to be hard on that. Yeah, Mary.
There's several different scenarios going on in this book. You have Vashti first disobeying the king's command. You have Mordecai disobeying the king's command. And here you have Esther. And the way she handles this, I think, is kind of the standout difference between all of that. It's really, and I'm not judging who's right and who's wrong in this as far as Vashti or Mordecai, but what I am saying is she doesn't just react. She doesn't just go with her emotions on this, how it seems like a lot of these people in the story have been doing it. She says, fast for me for 3 days, and right. I'm going to do the same. And there's, I think there's just a lot of wisdom offered to us in her behavior here.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I think you see some pretty extraordinary things in the character of these people, both Mordecai and Esther. But yeah, I agree. Esther's way of handling this is wise, isn't it? So, good. Anything to add to that? Yeah, Vina.
Just one last thing. I can read the whole story. I find it pretty amazing. I mean, here she's a queen. I mean, you know, she's next to the king. And yet it says a couple times in there that she's still obedient to Mordecai, like when she was a child. And I just think that's neat. I mean, it's amazing, but it's pretty cool that she respected him and still obeyed him when he was her father.
Yeah, very good. Great. All right, anything to add? All right, so what's Esther's plan then? In chapter 5, what does Esther do? She's got this king pretty figured out, doesn't she? Like, what's a good thing to do with a guy like this? Have a party, right? Have two parties. That's actually what she does. She has two banquets. She wants to make a request, but she waits until the second banquet. Who else does she invite to this? Haman, right? She invites the enemy to this party. Is he pretty excited about this? Yeah, he's very excited that he gets to be a part of this. Until verse 9. So, go to chapter 5, verse 9. Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart, and when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promised him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. All right. I don't want to ask wives what it would be like to be married to a guy like this, because some of you might be married to a guy like this. I don't know. But this guy can't see all of the good things and just let that be. There's this one guy that's not giving him the honor he thinks he deserves, and it negates everything else. And so he gets everybody around and says, let me tell you about how great I am. How can this guy not recognize it? It's pretty sad and immature. But any thoughts about that? Yeah, Mary.
The last time I studied this, I was thinking about how Esther really is like foreshadowing Christ here. That 3 days after fasting, she puts on a royal robes and goes before the king to save the people. We've got this Haman character that's there to kill God's people and to conquer him in that, and I just think it's a picture.
Yeah, very good. If you didn't catch that, there is some typology. There's some stuff going on here. 3 days, after the 3 days, she goes before the king to save her people. There's an enemy that wants to kill them. This is very much like a Christ figure story, right? Good. All right. What's the family and friends idea? Hey, I know you're bummed out about Mordecai, but what's the great plan? Yeah, let's build huge gallows and you'll kill him and that'll be great. So that's the idea. All right. What happens in chapter 6? This is, I think, a pretty important moment in the story. Yep.
Yes. Realizes that he never did anything to honor him in return.
Okay. What do you make of that happening on a night like this? So, like, here is a man planning to kill Mordecai, same man that's plotted the destruction of the Jews, and for whatever reason, the king can't sleep that night. And of all the things he could choose to do that night, he decides to have, almost using his own pride, right? Hey, read to me about how great I am. And they start reading all these chronicles of things that have happened. And one of the things is, there was a plot to kill you and your life was saved by a man named Mordecai. And the king says, wait, did we ever do anything for him? And the answer is no. We need to do something for him, right? Is that, like, what's that? That's providence, right? That's God. That's God using even the pride of somebody to get done what he wants to get done. So this is a very interesting moment in the story that, again, God's not mentioned, but his fingerprints are all over it. So, all right, other thoughts here? Now, what's great about this is when Haman shows up for the banquet the next day, the king asks a question to Haman. Haman, there's a guy I want to honor. What do you think I should do? Haman comes up with the plan about how to honor him. Because what's Haman thinking? He must be talking about me. So he comes up with this great thing. And it turns out he's talking about Mordecai. And then Haman is the one that has to, like, basically honor Mordecai and, like, parade him around. Pretty extraordinary thing. So, all right. Anything to add in chapter 6? All right. So finally, Esther makes her plea to the king. Look at chapter 7. Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen, and the king said to Esther on the second day also as they drank their wine at the banquet, What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you, and what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. Then Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do this? Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. It's quite a moment where Esther finds her courage, says what she needs to say about who she is. She also kind of cloaks it a little bit. She just says, hey, a plot's against me and my people. We're going to die. And he says, who's the man that did this? Haman's the man. So what happens to Haman? He pleads for his life, but he also ends up not getting it. And he dies on the gallows that he built to kill Mordecai. And then the king issues another decree. The law of the Persians was kind of different than the law of the Babylonians. A king didn't have a right to just say, never mind about that law. The law was above the king. So like when a king made a law in Persia, he couldn't just say, ignore it. That's why Daniel got thrown in the lion's den under the Persian regime, because he couldn't change the law that he made. But what could he do? What law could he give? Allow the Jews to defend themselves. So he basically writes another law and sends letters out and says, you have a right to defend yourself when these people try to attack. And it sounds like in the story, that would have caused many of the people just to lose heart over it, right? Because if they had a right to just kill people without defense, that would have been fine. But now that the Jews could arm themselves, that was another story. So, all right. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate the conversation. Next week, this Sunday, we will start the book of Hebrews. The booklets are in the lobby. And we will be doing that on Sundays and Wednesdays. So go ahead and get Hebrews and get started on it. And we'll talk more about it on Sunday.